This is the future Dark Overlord, Scott Sigler, and you are listening to Compensating Controls. Smart idea.
Synaptic Jam Productions presents Compensating Controls, the debut podcast novel from author James Keeling. Warning, parental guidance suggested for some language and mild to extreme scenes of violence.
Well, everybody, here it is. Episode number 21. Yes, this is the last episode of Compensating Controls. I want to take a quick moment to say thank you to all of you who've stuck with me through this process. It's been long and sometimes arduous, but the end is finally here. The big showdown at Connectron is at hand. Mano a mano, yada yada yada, and all that jazz. The orchestra is poised, the actors are set. So let's get on with it. Stay tuned after the story for a special announcement. Chapter 45. Pons Metall pulled off of Highway 13 and wound his way through the industrial park to the large rectangular building with the glowing Connectron sign out front. Driving around to the back of the building, he approached the loading dock area. He parked in a darkened area of the lot beside a large dumpster and collected himself. It was time. As long as he could take the guard quick enough, there wouldn't be any alarm for at least a little while. Reaching into his jacket, he withdrew his Colt, checked the clip, jacked a shell into the barrel, ensured the safety was on, and placed it back into its well-concealed holster. He verified the four extra clips strapped onto his chest harness, where they always were within easy reach. He didn't plan on eating them, but he had learned long ago the importance of being prepared for more trouble than was planned for. Lastly, he checked the two pouches strapped to the back of his belt. One contained the new gutting knife, the other the hunting knife, both of which he had used on Mr. Sigler. He was now looking forward to using them on Mr. Edgewood and Miss Cox. In reality, as well as they had worked, he still missed his own knife. But it was their fault that it was gone, and he would make them pay. He quietly exited the rental car and walked towards the loading dock. There was always a buzzer or phone by the loading dock, and he was planning on using it to gain entrance into the building. He had done this before, a simple buzz or phone call, and the guard on duty would come to the door expecting a late-night delivery. Once the door was open, a quick thrust under the ribcage and into the lungs would take care of both the guard and any sound he might have hoped to make. Pons slowly climbed the stairs, remaining alert for anybody who might already be on the loading dock. But he didn't see anyone. He walked towards the door and noticed that it stood ajar, a small coffee can keeping it wedged open. Looking into the can, he noticed a pile of cigarette butts and smiled.
"The poor fool left it open while on his last smoke break,"
he thought to himself, chuckling a little as he thought,
"Last smoke break. That's right, just like Mr. Sigler. What was the British phrase? Another nail in your coffin, those little buggers were."
Slowly, he pulled his weapon out and placed the fingers of his left hand around the edge of the door, pulling it towards him. The warehouse area of the building was actually very small, with a little office sequestered into the corner, and lit by only a single strip of halogen lights from above. The effect was to cast a grayish pall over the room, making it feel like a crypt. He proceeded through the dock area and slowly opened the door into a long, well-lit hallway. Peeking around the doorframe in both directions and seeing no one, he exited and turned right. As he walked, he noticed a humming or buzzing sound getting slowly louder. The hallway appeared to hit a dead end, but actually turned a corner to the left, and he could only assume he was actually walking around the perimeter of the building. As he came to a large set of double doors, he noticed the reason for the humming sound. The doors, which were propped open, led onto a gigantic data center floor, filled with racks of computer equipment. He walked into the room. Around the periphery of the racks were a number of large machines, which he assumed were cooling units, designed to maintain the climate within the data center. And these were all humming as they worked away, keeping the servers and assorted equipment in the room from overheating. He scanned the room, straining to see if there was any movement behind the rows and rows of racked equipment. Meanwhile, back in the operations room underneath Fort Snelling, an email is received. "So nice of you to join us, Mr. Matal," the voice rang out in the noisy room. It had been shouted, but was barely audible unless you were listening. And Pons Matal was definitely listening.
"Where are you? Come out and nobody will get hurt."
"Oh, I don't think so. Being murdered sounds kind of like getting hurt to me."
"All I want is location of data. That is all. You and Miss Cox are allowed to go free. Come out and talk to me like civilized man, Mr. Edgewood."
"I think I'm going to decline your offer. I may be a really nice guy, but saying that I'm civilized? Well, that's pushing it just a bit too far. Of course, I wouldn't really call you civilized either. I saw what you did to Scott, and there is no way in hell that was civilized at all."
"All the more reason for you to come out and deal with me directly. You know what I am capable of. I will get you eventually, Mr. Edgewood. And if not you, then the whore, Miss Cox. Sadly, she will not be treated well."
"The only thing you'll catch is a cold, Matal. Welcome to my world." And with that, the overhead lights, all of them, winked out, and the doors behind Pons closed with a resounding thud and whoosh of pressurized air. Although the overhead lights were out, the room was still bathed in an eerie combination of little green, white, and red lights. LEDs from the thousands of pieces of computer equipment provided just enough illumination to light up the location of the racks, but not much more. Pons turned around and tried to open the doors, but they were blocked from the outside.
"No matter," he thought. "What I want is right here." "Why the silly games, Mr. Edgewood?"
"They are neither silly nor games, Matal. If you want me, you're going to have to come and get me." Matal glanced down at his feet and found that the floor was more or less invisible, being shrouded in darkness as it was. He began to maneuver his way around the racks nearest to him, keeping his eyes and ears peeled for any sign of Nick, hoping the prey would give itself away quickly so he could end this.
"Where is Miss Cox?"
he taunted, rounding one row of servers and beginning to stalk down a second. "She's here. Yep, we're just one big happy family, we are. You can be the sadistic bastard of a father who deserves to be castrated and hung from a tree." Pon saw a flash of movement about 15 feet in front of him and set off running after the fleeing figure. He rounded the corner and suddenly his right foot tripped over something strung across the ground at about ankle height. Pons careened to the right, bouncing painfully off of a network-attached storage device and bruising his shoulder. He hit the ground hard, feeling as though he had twisted his ankle. He landed on his right shoulder, causing a jolt of pain to travel across his trapezius muscle and take a turn at his spine directly into his skull. He turned his head to see what had tripped him. Network cable had been strung across the ground between two racks, effectively creating a trap for the larger man. As Pons turned his head back around, something yellow flashed in front of his eyes and hit him in the forehead. He picked it up. It was a plastic ring of some sort, about 4 inches in diameter. He flung the ring aside and stood, once again straining to locate the fleeing figure.
"You are going to pay for that, little man," he shouted into the gloom.
"Not if I can help it," Nick answered, voice full of bravado. Pons heard the telltale sound of feet pounding across the floor. Limping slightly, he gave chase. He ran through the columns and rows of racks, as if they were majestic Roman columns. Occasionally, he would turn a corner, only to be pegged in the face with another small plastic ring, each time making him more and more angry. He turned a corner and saw Nick standing at the far end. In a flash, he drew the Colt and fired, causing Nick to duck down and dart behind the rack.
"You're a lousy shot, aren't you? You couldn't hit the broadside of the internet with an electric cattle prod."
"Tonight, you die by my hand!"
Pons bellowed, his voice resembling that of a bull moose issuing its challenge to any who could hear.
"Hey, Matal, talk to the hand, because the port's not listening!"
Pons tore off after him at top speed, his throbbing ankle forgotten in his rage. He rounded the corner, and remembering the last time he went chasing after his quarry, pulled up short. He saw in front of him a number of servers that had been pulled out from the racks on rolling rails, forming a horizontal minefield in front of him. some at knee height and some at the level of his eyes.
"I will not fall for that again,"
he roared, and hopping past the rows of racks, slowly crept down the next aisle. Nick turned a corner and then felt himself thrown backwards by an immense blow right across his ribcage. He had just expelled a deep breath and he couldn't seem to draw any air into his lungs. Ponsmetal advanced and stood over him as he lay on the ground, clutching his arms about his chest and rocking from side to side.
"So, Mr. Edgewood, finally we come to it."
Metal replaced the pistol into its holster and began to reach behind his back for his knives, only to stop and gaze confidently at Nick as he lay on the floor.
"No, I think not. The blade we shall save for later. I had nice conversation with myself on how to deal with you. I see anger and defiance in your eyes. Mr. Wallace had same anger in his eyes. Yes, he had decades of anger. He broke in minutes."
Pons planted a kick into Nick's midsection that drove the smaller man about 2 feet across the floor, and Nick disgorged the contents of his stomach as Metal paced back and forth. With the lights out, Nick did not see the red blood mixed in with his vomit.
"Mr. Sigler, on the other hand, had no anger, which was odd. He had only fear. But not fear of me. No, he did not fear me. He feared for his family. I could see it in his eyes, you understand. His eyes spoke to me as he tried to beg. But not beg for himself, but for his family. His damn eyes. That is why they had to go."
While Pons was speaking, Nick had come to enough to drag himself next to a tall computer rack. His left shoulder was throbbing with pain, and the gunshot wound on his arm had reopened, allowing blood to drip onto the tiled floor. He painfully sat up, placing his back against the rack.
"I would have finished his wife and children, but detective in front of house served as effective deterrent. I believe I will visit them anyway, after you are dead."
Pons walked over to Nick and noticed the very top server of the rack next to him had been pulled all the way out on its rails and extended far into the aisle. Another trap. He tapped the server with his finger.
"I must hand it to you, Nicholas. Really, quite ingenious, if ineffectual."
The assassin squatted down directly beneath the looming server, his form lit by the blinking LEDs of the other servers in the rack, illuminating only the left side of his face, as if he were wearing a mask. He fixed Nick with eyes that promised nothing but pain, agony, and the repeated refusal of a quick death. As he stared at Nick, Metal noticed that a blue cable had been hung down from the end of the extended top server. He saw a grin spread across the young man's face as his right hand snatched the cable and jerked downward. When loading computer racks with equipment, it is always important to load them from the bottom and be acutely aware of the center of gravity. A large server pulled out on rails has been known to topple an entire rack if located high enough. In this case, the server was a massive Sun V880, 71.4 inches tall and weighing in excess of 250 pounds. It had been precariously perched, and a simple pull on the length of network cord caused it to topple forward, bringing the entire rack with it. Nick had originally intended it to be something he pulled as he ran past, but the opportunity seemed a bit too good to pass up. Metal barely had time to look up before the huge rack fell on him, breaking his clavicle on the left side as it pinned him to the ground. Nick hauled himself to his feet, glad that it was finally over. He turned his back on the broken man and began to hobble away. Impossibly, the sound of wrenching metal erupted from behind him, and he turned to see the huge mammoth of a man haul himself onto his feet, his left arm dangling painfully by his side. In the subdued lighting of the data center, it appeared as if a monster had erupted from a nightmare to walk the earth. Metal bellowed a primal challenge at the smaller man. He was Alpha. He was the biggest and he was the strongest. There would be no weapons here. He would rend the nuisance apart with his bare hands. With a howl, Metal ran at Nick, who turned and fled. As Metal rounded the next corner, he saw Nick struggling to run from him. He ignored the pain in his left shoulder and raised both of his hands, clenching them into fists. His hands, the hands that had served him so well. He charged at the figure, who seemed to be almost hopping now, his left leg dragging a little behind him as he leapt to get away.
Good. A wounded kill is still a kill.
Ponza's feet thudded on the floor as he charged. Just before he reached his quarry, his right leg came down to hit nothing but air. With a sickening sensation, he realized the data center had a raised tile floor to allow for the running of cables and power, and also to allow for the circulation of the cool air generated by the air conditioners. His right knee hit the far side of the 1 yard square hole in the floor, and he both felt and heard the cracking of bone. The pain quickly traveled up his body to overwhelm his nervous system and send him into an immediate state of shock. He caught a fleeting glimpse of the shadowy figure as it disappeared. Slowly, painfully, Pons pulled himself back into a sitting position on the tile next to the hole. His knee was bent at an odd angle, and he knew he wouldn't be able to use it again for quite some time. He reached behind his back to grasp the handle of the large hunting knife. His eyes squinted shut against the pain. The room had yet to come back into focus, and Metal struggled to overcome the dizziness which had washed over him like a tidal wave, following the carnage that had been wrought on his leg. He did not see the floor tile behind him slowly start to rise. Like a member of a SEAL team in a ghillie suit, Nick rose out of the floor, brandishing his weapon. Pons Metal, professional assassin and torturing bastard, sensed someone behind him. He managed a quick intake of breath. Chapter 46. When Rob pulled back into the parking lot of Connectron, he was more than a little bit surprised to see about 30 vehicles where none had been only an hour or two ago. "Oh my God, Nick, what have you done?" he said quietly to himself as he pulled in front of the main door and exited from his vehicle. Immediately, 15 men in flak jackets and carrying automatic weapons turned to him, screaming at him to get down, kiss the pavement, and make one sudden move and I'll blow your frickin' head off. Meanwhile, inside the building, Nick sat on the cold, hard floor of the data center, his hands cuffed behind his back. Blood was slowly seeping down the right side of Nick's face. No less than 4 armed men were training their weapons on him. Paramedics had been called to see to the wounded and would arrive soon. Turning one of the corners, Nick had inadvertently tripped one of his own traps and caught his cheek on an ejected CD-ROM tray. Silly, really, but he could tell that Metal had definitely gotten the worst of it. Once the cavalry had arrived, it had swarmed into the data center, halogen lights attached to the business end of their weapons, sweeping everywhere around the room, creating an almost psychedelic strobe effect as the beams winked in and out of the neatly arranged rows of computer gear. Nick had just dropped the large shovel as they rounded the corner and saw him with his arms raised. They immediately, and none too gently, seized Nick and trussed him up like a Thanksgiving turkey, propping him against a rack. It had taken Nick almost 5 minutes to walk one of them through finding the breaker switch, eventually flooding the room with light. Peter, Juan, and Brent came jogging up to the front door of Connectron. Well, Peter and Juan jogged. Brent kind of huffed and puffed up behind them. An agent was by the door debriefing Rob when the men arrived, their respective badges and credentials attached to the outside of their bulletproof vests. "Sit, rep?" Peter asked as he walked up to the agent.
"The area is secure, sir. They're in a large data center located in the middle of the building. Just go straight in, just down the hall and through the double doors."
"Thanks, Tom," Peter replied as they walked into the building. When they finally found Nick, he was sitting quietly, his head leaning back on the cold metal of the rack behind him, his eyes half-lidded as though he were about to doze off. Brent went to talk to the first officer on the scene, while Peter and Julio walked over to Nick.
"Nicholas Edgewood, I presume," Peter offered.
Agent Peter Hoffman. It's truly a pleasure to finally meet you. I see you found the place all right. Well, when you sent an email with directions from our supposedly classified location to this building, complete with GPS coordinates and a Google map, with street views of all the turns, I might add, it's kind of hard to get lost. So, this is our bad guy? Peter motioned a hand over to where Pons Matal lay, still unconscious from the blow to the head. He's the one who killed Scott. But I don't think he's the real bad guy. Cassandra said it's somebody who calls himself the Controller. Nick's eyes narrowed as he said this, knowing the person who engineered all of this, virtually ruined his life, was still out there somewhere. You mentioned the Controller already, but that's a conversation for another time. Speaking of Miss Cox, where is she? She's not outside? I had her stationed in a small office down the hall from the entrance. She's the one who closed the doors and locked that madman in here. With you? Peter asked. Yes, with me, Nick said. And where is she now? Well, she was supposed to wait outside and greet you when you arrived. She wasn't there? Not to my knowledge. Julio had walked over to where Matal lay. The man's weapons had been removed and were lying on the ground about 10 feet from his body. He glanced first at the hunting knife, and then the gutting tool, and the image of Scott Sigler, his abdomen slit open like a deer, caused a flush of anger to wash over him. He resisted the urge to end Matal then and there, instead electing to ensure his restraints were nice and tight, pulling roughly on the zip ties which bound the killer's wrists, and grunting in satisfaction as plastic bit deeply into flesh. As he stood and walked back over to the others, he inadvertently stepped on the broken leg, which brought Matal back to consciousness with a howl of pain. "Whoops, sorry about that," he remarked dryly. "Well, Mr. Edgewood, you seem to have bagged yourself a big one." "Thanks. I don't think we've met. My name is Nick." "Julio Hernandez. I've been helping out ever since you knocked this piece of crap out back in the alley. Good work, by the way. You handle a shovel very well." "Yes," said Peter, drawing Nick's attention away from Julio. "About that. Nick, you wouldn't happen to have something like data about you, would you? Look around, Agent Hoffman. You're surrounded by it." "Please, call me Peter, and I believe we both know what I'm talking about. We were under the impression that your friend over there was in possession of it, but for some reason I believe that is no longer the case." "Well, Peter, I'd like to help you, but I appear to be all tied up at the moment." "Well, let's just see what we can do about that then, shall we?" Peter had one of the officers cut the ties around Nick's ankles and then help him to his feet. The cords binding his hands were soon removed as well, and Nick rubbed his wrists, urging circulation back into them. "I've spent the last few days doing everything I could to avoid having those things put on me, and now I can see why." The data? Peter prompted. "Oh, yeah, that." Nick began walking, Peter and Julio close behind. Three other officers made to follow, but were waved off by the senior agent. Nick walked up to a rack, opened the door, and pulled on a handle. What appeared to be a small box, about the size of a large pizza, protruded from the middle of the rack, and when Nick pulled up on it, revealed a small LED screen and a keyboard with a trackball mouse. He began typing rapidly, and a CD-ROM tray ejected from the topmost server, revealing a small piece of bloodied paper. Setting it down next to the keyboard, Nick began to type. As he typed, he felt the pain and anxiety of the day melt away. He launched a file transfer program and, referencing the paper, logged into a secure FTP server which happened to be located in Europe. FTP 172.27.200.241. Username, Byteit. Password, Honey4P0T. LS, img-001.jpg. img002.jpg. img03.jpg. LCD:\temp. Bin, hash, mget star. The screen filled with row upon row of exclamation points as the files were pulled across the internet and deposited on the local hard drive of the server. The Three files were copied. RM-R. Splat. Nick turned to Peter. Well, here they are, but they're image files. Now let me pull them up. Nick quickly launched an image editing program and opened the JPEG files. One was of a horse grazing in a field. One was a red tricycle. And the last was of a cartoon character. Interesting. Is this the data you were looking for? Nick queried. Not that I know of, Peter confessed. It could be stegocryptography, Nick offered. A stego what? Asked Julio, clearly baffled by the word. Stegocryptography. It's where you hide data within the unnecessary bits of an image file. They used an algorithm to embed the data in such a way that the image looks the same, but it carries the data with it. It's been used for quite a while, actually. Can you decode it? Peter asked. Well, my buddy Scott... Nick paused, remembering what he had lost because of this data. Well, my buddy Scott was the real expert here, but, you know, let me see what I can do. Nick went back to the keyboard and began downloading programs to pull out the appropriate bits and decode the image data. Once he was done, he brought up the information in a text editor, and they all began reading. Report from Agent Harwood. Deep Undercover. Project GIGO. Subject, the Controller, a.k.a. Xavier Hawthorne. International arms dealer with ties to militants and terrorists in multiple theaters around the globe. Details of a major terrorist attack within the United States. The file went on to give names, dates, locations, and details about a coordinated attack on the infrastructure of several major metropolitan areas of the United States, Minneapolis-St. Paul included. For Peter Hoffman, everything clicked home. The reason for the urgency assigned to the task, the strange location of the data, the time sensitivity of the data that was stolen, the lengths to which this Xavier Hawthorne had been willing to go to procure it. As they reached the end of the report, they all saw the last entry. I have fled to Munich using my third alternate identity, but I know he is close behind me. I've heard of this man. Mittal is his name. I do not want to be captured by him and will take the capsule if it becomes apparent that I will be. I have seen his work before. I continue to save my log data on the Allied Computing Database, as it appears to still be secure. Nick let out a low whistle. So that's what this has all been about, he commented dryly. Yes, Nick, it is, replied Peter. That's why we're here, and why we do what it is that we do. So now what happens to me? Nick asked, trying to hide the apprehension in his voice. Well, you do realize that my boss thinks you're as guilty as hell. And what do you think? We both know what I think. Peter sighed visibly. I believe that with the evidence we have, and most importantly, the data, I think you'll be all right. Epilogue. The debriefing had taken the better part of 2 days. Deputy Director Sands had brought in his own interrogators, who had been merciless in their questioning of Nick. Due to the nature of the crimes involved, no lawyer was present for his questioning. Although this had initially incensed Nick, once he thought of Mittal sitting in the same position, he was glad. There was no way he wanted that scum to be able to hide behind a weasel of a lawyer. Slowly, all of the details about the last few days, save one, came out, and in the end, not only was Nick released, but he received a $500,000 reward for the capture of Pons Mittal and the recovery of the data. After locking the doors behind the assassin, Cassandra had fled. When Nick had been released, he had tried to find her. But everywhere he turned, there was no sign. He returned to the apartment, but all of her things were gone. Her friend Sarah hadn't heard from her, and Nick was pretty sure that she wouldn't admit to it even if she had. When he checked the PayPal account, he saw the $10,000 of the money had been removed. Silently, he hoped she'd found a way to escape what had become of her life, and that she'd been able to start anew. the $500,000 reward he gave to Jeannie Sigler and her boys. No amount of money could have replaced him, either as a husband or a father or a friend. But he hoped it would help. He attended the funeral where Jeannie had cried on his shoulder, and the boys had wrapped their little arms around him, as they had done so many times before. He would continue to help them wherever he could. That he knew. That he promised. After his interrogation, Pons Mattal was placed in a medical ward until his broken collarbone and shattered knee could be mended. He was then shipped off to an undisclosed prison somewhere. Hopefully never to be seen again, Nick thought. May he rot in hell. Agent Peter Hoffman walked into Nora's coffee shop and walked up to the counter. Almost a month had passed since Nick's release. Ashton smiled at him from her place in front of the large Cymbali espresso machine and greeted him.
Peter, it's so very nice to see you again.
Well, hello there, Ashton. I'm here to see...
Macchiato. Yes, I know. He's sitting at your usual table. One coffee with whip coming right up.
You're amazing. You know that, don't you?
Of course I do, silly. It's just the rest of the world that has yet to come around.
She grinned at him, placing his mug of coffee on the counter. Peter turned and strode towards a table in the back corner. As he approached, he noticed Nick's face. It was such a drastic counterpoint to the image he had studied on the ATM footage. The eyes seemed to reflect the pain and sadness the man had endured, but they also showed a quiet strength and the depth of maturity that comes with knowing how to deal with it. Peter knew at that moment he was making the right decision. He sat, placing his mug in front of him.
Well, Nick, how have you been?
Nick's lips pursed into a lopsided grin.
Well, I'd say I can't complain, but of course I could. It just wouldn't get me anywhere.
How about you, Peter? How's your day going?
More of the same. Not the worst I've had, but definitely not the best.
They sat in relative silence for a minute, while the din of the coffee house swirled around them.
Nick, I've got a proposition for you. You've shown yourself to be well qualified as a technical analyst, and as it so happens, I've got an opening.
Nick opened his mouth to speak, but Peter interrupted by holding up his hand.
Give me a minute, Nick, and then respond. Like I said, I've got an opening. And with all the background research we've done on you, well, you've already got most of the security clearance paperwork basically done. It would require relocating, because there's no opening in the local office. But I'd like to have you on my team. You can take a little while to think about it, but not for too long. The rec won't be open forever, and I've got to fill it.
Nick sat and thought. Minnesota had been his home for his entire life. He had stayed in this area, despite all the hard winters, the constant road construction, and now the memories of what had just happened to him and to those he cared for. He had changed. He knew that. He was no longer the shy kid who was too afraid to move far away from the house in which he grew up. He was no longer the same boy who was afraid to talk to girls. He was someone different entirely. Besides, that $40,000 wouldn't last forever.
Sure, why not?
Xavier Hawthorne sat back in his chair. Things had become more complicated than was necessary, and complications were something he tended to avoid. This was by no means over. Yes, some dates, times, and individuals would have to change, but the basic premise of the plan was still viable, and adjustments could be made. It had been a shame that Mr. Mattal had failed, but no matter. He had learned long ago that to obsess about the past was to sacrifice the future. Take the situation, analyze it, make adjustments, and move forward. And that was exactly what he intended to do. The end.
Call it.
Well, that's it. I'm resisting the urge and the temptation to give you my thoughts. Please, Let me know what you think first, and then we'll go from there. But, James, what about the Q&A episode? Shouldn't you have a Q&A episode? Well, I suppose so. So send me some questions. Please, please do. The existence of the Q&A episode is dependent entirely on you. If I have Q's, I'll give you A's. All right. So short and sweet, that's it for compensating controls. But what about the future? What does the future hold, you might ask? Well, there's big things on the horizon. As you know, Compensating Controls was published via my own feed as well as via Podiobooks.com. I fought long and hard with myself. You know, actually, physically fought. You know, Fight Club style. With what to do. I can honestly say that podcasting Compensating Controls on both my own feed as well as Podiobooks.com, well, it rails against my already split personality. It is for this reason that I have chosen to more effectively utilize the distribution channels available to me. Given the nature of the podcast novel space, Podiobooks.com is the place for podcast novel fiction, available now at Podiobooks.com. So, novels will be on Podiobooks. But, you might stammer, what about the chatter? I mean, that's part of the reason you're here, isn't it? Well, obviously my chatter isn't so horrible that it drives you away. So what shall we do about the chatter? Chatter. Well, as I was saying, my podcast novels will appear on Podiobooks, while on my own feed, you'll find... Wait for it. The Synaptic Chattercast. That's right, and I'm here to tell you. Novel and Potty Books, chatter on the Synaptic Chattercast, and never the twixt shall meet. Short story, flash, and whatnot may appear in the Chattercast, but nothing over, say, 5,000 words or so. And speaking of fiction over 5,000 words, the next novel-length production from Synaptic Jam Productions and James Keeling will be Subversion, Sacrifice, and Salvation. Lest you become enamored with the technical thriller, Subversion, Sacrifice, and Salvation is more akin to an urban fantasy. A bit more action as well. Okay, quite a bit more action. Okay, fine, a hell of a lot more action. More information about that podcast novel as time passes. My initial thought for Subversion, Sacrifice, and Salvation, or S3, is to have additional voices. While I do enjoy and like a straight read, there's something about having great, talented people be part of a story, and I want to be a part of that. As you can probably surmise, S3 is not a sequel to Compensating Controls. Does this mean that we'll never hear from Nicholas Edgewood again? Well, of course not. A large part of it will depend solely on what I hear from you. But what about the interim time, you may ask, between Compensating Controls and S3, or Subversion, Sacrifice, and Salvation? Well, I'll be putting a little bit of this and a little bit of that in the feed for your listening pleasure. Some fiction, maybe some interviews, whatever I can kind of scrounge up. We'll see what I can pull together. There's a lot of great podcasts out there that already do this very, very well, so hopefully I'll be able to make it interesting enough to keep you around. That's about it. That's all that I've got for me. Yeah, there we go. Thank you so very much for listening. If you really enjoyed it, please stop by the website. You can donate money if you want to from there. Please buy a copy of the ebook. There's a link in the link on the website for that as well. And I believe that's it. So, until next time. Hold on. Me. Oh, big boy voice. There we go. I like my big boy voice. Okay. So,
and for here's now, a quick promo.
This is James Keeling of Synaptic Jam Productions, wishing you clear skies and a crimson sunset.
You have been listening to Compensating Controls, the breakout novel by podcast author James Keeling. For more information and more content, please visit the website at www.jameskeeling.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Synaptic Jam, or like me on Facebook, also at Synaptic Jam. Music and sounds generously provided by Incompetech.com and Freesound.org. Compensating Controls is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 Unported License. So please, share it with everyone and spread the word. Just don't change it or make money off it. Or, if you do, please send that money to me. Swiss bank account available upon request.
Hi, Jeff. How is my evil alter ego this evening?
I thought you were the evil one.
Well, come on. My name is Mike Plested, and yours is the Dark Lord Height.
Point taken.
So, what did you call about, and what's all that racket in the background?
Well, that is what I called about. See, I think we have a problem.
Oh?
See, I was feeding some data into Alex, you know, the Beowulf supercomputer, and he started, well, I don't know how to put this. He's self-aware, and he's using parts of my office to build himself a mobile body. I'm kind of hoping you could call in the Mounties.
Jeff. I told you to wait to do that until after the book comes out. A Method to the Madness and Guide to the Super Evil. We'll start collecting essays and stories from other evil geniuses for the up-and-coming mad scientists soon. If you just waited for the anthology to come out, I'm sure you would have seen some advice in there. You know, about what data is safe to upload to your Beowulf cluster.
Well, I just thought... Oh, I don't know. So where can I find this book?
Well, that's the problem. It's not out yet, but they will be open for submissions on January 1st, 2012. And you can find out more information about the whole thing at http://madscientistanthology.wordpress.com.
Well, that sounds great. Thanks.
You know, maybe you should write an essay about how to survive when your Beowulf supercluster becomes self-aware. That is, if you survive.
Thanks. I'll keep that in mind. Look, I gotta go. You are gonna call the Mounties, right?
Jeff? Oh well, I hope he figures it out.
http://madscientistanthology.wordpress.com.
Call it.
After locking the doors behind the... That's change. And that she being able to start anew. You can do better than that, can't you? Okay. He was then shipped off to an undisc... Face change. Last few pages. How much time I got left here? I have about 12 minutes left, and I'm already 3 minutes into it. It's fine. Okay. Sheet change. How have you been, Nick? Well, Nick, how have you been? Use whichever one you want. Nick opened his mouth to speak, but Peter... Okay. Nick opened his mouth to speak. See, was that too fast, though? All right, I'm to it again. Let's see, decide which one you want. Okay, scene change. I'm going to do that then. From his body. He glanced at... He began typing rapidly in a CD-ROM tray ejected... Did I really put down ejected it? Ejected. Thank you. I need a drink. Meow meow. I'm almost done.
All right, ready?
Back on the infrastructure.
Okay.
The file. And why we do what it is that we do. Whoa, that's just a tongue twister right there. I really would have put up.
Well, someone's got to go to jail.
End of chapter. Whatever chapter it was. Scene change. And any sound he might have hoped to make. A small coffee can keeping it wedged open.
Why are they making noise?
What is wrong with me and the word little? Okay. The warehouse area of the building was actually very small. With a little office sequestered into the corner. Scene change.
Come out and talk to me like civilized man, Mr. Edgewood.
He taunted, rounding one row of servers and beginning to stalk down a second. As Natal rounded the next corner, As Natal rounded the next corner.
Call it.